Chapter 8. Gone shrinkingly on such an errand. But not a bit of it. The force of pedestrian genius, I suppose. I raced by his side in a mood of profound self-derision, and infinitely vexed with that minx. Because dead or alive I thought of her as a minx. Dot, I smiled incredulously at Marlowe's ferocity. But Marlowe, pausing with a whimsically retrospective air, never flinched. Yes, yes. Even dead. And now you are shocked. You see, you are such a chivalrous masculine beggar. But there is enough of the woman in my nature to free my judgment of women from glamorous reticency. And then, why should I upset myself? A woman is not necessarily either a doll or an angel to me. She is a human being, very much like myself. And I have come across too many dead souls lying so, to speak at the foot of high unscalable places for a merely possible dead body at the bottom of a quarry, to strike my sincerity dumb. The cliff-like face of the quarry looked forbiddingly impressive. I will admit that fine, and I hung back for a moment, before we made a plunge off the road into the bushes growing in a broad space at the foot of the towering limestone wall. These bushes were heavy with dew. There were also concealed mud holes in there. We crept and tumbled and felt about with our hands along the ground. We got wet, scratched, and plastered with mire all over our nether garments. Fine fell suddenly into a strange cavity, probably a disused lime kiln. His voice, uplifted in grave distress, sounded more than usually rich, solemn, and profound. This was the comic relief of an absurdly dramatic situation. While hauling him out, I permitted myself to laugh aloud at last. Fine, of course, didn't. I need not tell you that we found nothing after a most conscientious search. Fine even pushed his way into a decaying shed half buried in dew-soaked vegetation. He struck matches, several of them too, as if to make absolutely sure that the vanished girlfriend of his wife was not hiding there. The short flares illuminated his grave, immovable countenance while I let myself go completely and laughed in peals. I asked him if he really and truly supposed that any sane girl would go and hide in that shed. And if so, why? Disdainful of my mirth, he merely muttered his basso profundo thankfulness that we had not found her anywhere about there. Having grown extremely sensitive and affect of irritation to the tonalities, I may say, of this affair, I felt that it was only an imperfect, reserved thankfulness, with one eye still on the possibilities of the several ponds in the neighborhood. And I remember I snorted, I positively snorted, at that poor Fine. What really jarred upon me was the rate of his walking. Differences in politics, in ethics, and even in aesthetics need not arouse angry antagonism. One's opinion may change, one's tastes may alter, in fact they do. One's very conception of virtue is at the mercy of some felicitous temptation which may be sprung on one any day. All these things are perpetually on the swing. But a temperamental difference, temperament being immutable, is the parent of hate. That's why religious quarrels are the fiercest of all. My temperament, in matters pertaining to solid land, is the temperament of leisurely movement, of deliberate gait. And there was that little Fine pounding along the road in a most offensive manner, a man wedded to thick-soled, laced boots. Whereas my temperament demands thin shoes of the lightest kind. Of course there could never have been question of friendship between us, but under the provocation of having to keep up with his pace I began to dislike him actively. I begged sarcastically to know whether he could tell me if we were engaged in a farce or in a tragedy. I wanted to regulate my feelings which, I told him, were in an unbecoming state of confusion. But Fine was as impervious to sarcasm as a turtle. He tramped on, and all he did was to ejaculate twice out of his deep chest, vaguely, doubtfully. I am afraid. Dot dot, I am afraid. Dot dot, this was tragic. The thump of his boots was the only sound in the shadowy world. I kept by his side with a comparatively ghostly silent tread. By a strange illusion, the road appeared to run up against a lot of low stars at no very great distance. But as we advanced, new stretches of whitey brown ribbon seemed to come up from under the black ground. I observed, as we went by, the lamp in my parlor in the farmhouse still burning. But I did not leave Fine to run in and put it out. The impetus of his pedestrian excellence carried me past in his wake before I could make up my mind. "Tell me, Fine," I cried, "you don't think the girl was mad, do you?" He answered nothing. Soon the lighted beacon-like window of the cottage came into view. Then Fine uttered a solemn, "Certainly not," with profound assurance. But immediately after he added a very highly strung young person indeed, which unsettled me again. Was it a tragedy? Nobody ever got up at 6 o'clock in the morning to commit suicide, I declared crustily. "'Tis unheard of. This is a farce." As a matter of fact, it was neither farce nor tragedy. Coming up to the cottage, we had a view of Mrs. Fine inside, still sitting in the strong light at the round table with folded arms. It looked as though she had not moved her very head by as much as an inch since we went away. She was amazing in a sort of unsubtle way. Crudely amazing, I thought. Why crudely? I don't know. Perhaps because I saw her then in a crude light. I mean this materially in the light of an unshaded lamp. Our mental conclusions depend so much on momentary physical sensations, don't they? If the lamp had been shaded, I should perhaps have gone home, after expressing politely my concern at the Fine's unpleasant predicament. Losing a girlfriend in that manner is unpleasant. It is also mysterious. So mysterious that a certain mystery attaches to the people to whom such a thing does happen. Moreover, I had never really understood the Fines, he with his solemnity which extended to the very eating of bread and butter, she with that air of detachment and resolution in breasting the commonplace current of their unexciting life, in which the cutting of bread and butter appeared to me, by a long way, the most dangerous episode. Sometimes I amused myself by supposing that to their minds this world of ours must be wearing a perfectly overwhelming aspect, and that their heads contained respectively awfully serious and extremely desperate thoughts, and trying to imagine what an exciting time they must be having of it in the inscrutable depths of their being. This last was difficult to a volatile person. I am sure that to the Fines I was a volatile person, and the amusement in itself was not very great, but still in the country away from all mental stimulants. My efforts had invested them with a sort of amusing profundity. But when Fine and I got back into the room, then in the searching, domestic glare of the lamp, inimical to the play of fancy, I saw these two stripped of every vesture that amused me to put on them for fun. Queer enough they were. Is there a human being that isn't that more or less secretly? But whatever their secret, it was manifest to me that it was neither subtle nor profound. They were a good, stupid, earnest couple and very much bothered. They were that with the usual unshaded crudity of average people. There was nothing in them that the lamplight might not touch without the slightest risk of indiscretion. Directly we had entered the room, Fine announced the result by saying nothing in the same tone as at the gate on his return from the railway station. And as then Mrs. Fine uttered an incisive, "Tease what I've said," which might have been the veriest echo of her words in the garden, we three looked at each other as if on the brink of a disclosure. I don't know whether she was vexed at my presence. It could hardly be called intrusion, could it? Little Fine began it. It had to go on. We stood before her, plastered with the same mud. Fine was a sight. Comma scratched by the same brambles, conscious of the same experience. Yes. Before her. And she looked at us with folded arms, with an extraordinary fullness of assumed responsibility. I addressed her. You don't believe in an accident, Mrs. Fine, do you? She shook her head in curt negation while, caked in mud and inexpressibly serious-faced, Fine seemed to be backing her up with all the weight of his solemn presence. Nothing more absurd could be conceived. It was delicious. and I went on in deferential accents. Am I to understand then, that you entertain the theory of suicide? I don't know that I am liable to fits of delirium, but by a sudden and alarming aberration, while waiting for her answer I became mentally aware of three trained dogs dancing on their hind legs. I don't know why. Perhaps because of the pervading solemnity. There's nothing more solemn on earth than a dance of trained dogs. As he has chosen to disappear. That's all. In these words Mrs. Fine answered me. The aggressive tone was too much for my endurance. In an instant I found myself out of the dance, and down on all fours so to speak, with liberty to bark and bite. The devil as he has, I cried. As chosen to. Like this, all at once, anyhow, regardless. I've had the privilege of meeting that reckless and brusque young lady and I must say that with her air of an angry victim. Precisely, Mrs. Fine said very unexpectedly like a steel trap going off. I stared at her. How provoking she was. So I went on to finish my tirade. He struck me at first sight as the most inconsiderate wrong-headed girl that I ever. Why should a girl be more considerate than anyone else? More than any man, for instance? Inquired Mrs. Fine with a still greater assertion of responsibility in her bearing. Of course I exclaimed at this, not very loudly it is true, but forcibly. Were then the feelings of friends, relations and even of strangers to be disregarded? I asked Mrs. Fine if she did not think it was a sort of duty to show elementary consideration, not only for the natural feelings, but even for the prejudices of one's fellow creatures. Her answer knocked me over. Not for a woman. Just like that. I confess that I went down flat. And while in that collapsed state I learned the true nature of Mrs. Fine's feminist doctrine. It was not political, it was not social. It was a knock-me-down doctrine, a practical individualistic doctrine. You would not thank me for expounding it to you at large. Indeed, I think that she herself did not enlighten me fully. There must have been things not fit for a man to hear. But shortly, and as far as my bewilderment allowed me to grasp its naive atrociousness, it was something like this. That no consideration, no delicacy, no tenderness, no scruples should stand in the way of a woman who by the mere fact of her sex, was the predestined victim of conditions created by men's selfish passions, their vices and their abominable tyranny, from taking the shortest cut toward securing for herself the easiest possible existence. As he had even the right to go out of existence without considering anyone's feelings or convenience, since some women's existences were made impossible by the short-sighted baseness of men. I looked at her, sitting before the lamp at 1 o'clock in the morning, with her mature, smooth-cheeked face of masculine shape robbed of its freshness by fatigue, and her eyes dimmed by this senseless vigil. I looked also at Fine. The mud was drying on him. He was obviously tired. The weariness of solemnity. But he preserved an unflinching, endorsing, gravity of expression. Endorsing it all as became a good, convinced husband. Oh. I see, I said. Oh consideration. Well I hope you like it. They amused me beyond the wildest imaginings of which I was capable. After the first shock, you understand, I recovered very quickly. The order of the world was safe enough. He was a civil servant, and she his good and faithful wife. But when it comes to dealing with human beings anything may be expected. So even my astonishment did not last very long. How far she developed and illustrated that conscienceless and austere doctrine to the girlfriends, who were mere transient shadows to her husband, I could not tell. Any length I supposed. And he looked on, acquiesced, approved, just for that very reason, because these pretty girls were but shadows to him. Oh, most virtuous Fine. He cast his eyes down. He didn't like it. But I eyed him with hidden animosity for he had got me to run after him under somewhat false pretenses. Mrs. Fine had only smiled at me very expressively, very self-confidently. I quite understand that you accept the fullest responsibility, I said. I'm the only ridiculous person in this. I don't know how to call it performance. However, I've nothing more to do here, so I'll say good night or good morning, for it must be past one. But before departing, in common decency, I offered to take any wires they might write. My lodgings were nearer the post office than the cottage, and I would send them off the first thing in the morning. I supposed they would wish to communicate, if only as to the disposal of the luggage, with the young lady's relatives. Fine, he looked rather downcast by then, thanked me and declined. There is really no one, he said, very grave. No one, I exclaimed. Practically, said curt Mrs. Fine. And my curiosity was aroused again. Ah, I see. An orphan. Mrs. Fine looked away weary and somber, and Fine said as impulsively, and then qualified the affirmative by the quaint statement. Oh, a certain extent. I became conscious of a languid, exhausted embarrassment, bowed to Mrs. Fine, and went out of the cottage, to be confronted outside its door by the bespangled, cruel revelation of the immensity of the universe. The night was not sufficiently advanced for the stars to have paled, and the earth seemed to me more profoundly asleep, perhaps, because I was alone now. Not having Fine with me to set the pace, I let myself drift, rather than walk, in the direction of the farmhouse. To drift is the only reposeful sort of motion, ask any ship, if it isn't, and therefore consistent with thoughtfulness. And I pondered. How is one an orphan? Oh, a certain extent. No amount of solemnity could make such a statement other than bizarre. What a strange condition to be in. Very likely one of the parents only was dead? But no, it couldn't be, since Fine had said just before that here was really no one to communicate with. No one. And then remembering Mrs. Fine's snappy, practically my thoughts fastened upon that lady as a more tangible object of speculation. I wondered and wondering I doubted whether she really understood herself the theory as he had propounded to me. Everything may be said indeed ought to be said providing we know how to say it. She probably did not. She was not intelligent enough for that. As he had no knowledge of the world. As he had got hold of words as a child might get hold of some poisonous pills and play with them for ear, tiny little marbles. No. The domestic slave daughter of Carly and Anthony, and the little Fine of the civil service, that flower of civilization, were not intelligent people. They were commonplace, earnest, without smiles and without guile. But he had his solemnities and as he had her reveries, her lurid, violent, crude. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.